You know she doesn't tell lies, and it is obvious that she is not mad. For the moment, then, and unless any further evidence turns up, we must assume that she is telling the truth. And it's just this perfect, logical expression that students can hold on to. So The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is one of my favorite books. I grew up reading Narnia. My mom introduced it to me at an early age. I watched the BBC versions of Narnia. And so this is a book near and dear to my heart. It kickstarted my love for fantasy. I mean, I read Tolkien because of Lewis. And so this is one that I've really been excited to get to. Obviously, heavily marked up. Also, lots of notes on it.
Lee's is in pieces.
In pieces, yes.
Yeah.
So we've got a lot to cover in this one. And so let's just get to it.
That's great.
So one of the first questions that we want to ask here is, how does perspective contribute to contentment or dissatisfaction? Where do you see that?
So first off, we have to say that Lewis is brilliant. And the thing that I love about all of Narnia is his consistency in philosophy and his consistency in theology and his ability to make these important truths visible and illustrate them for children and adults alike. So you're going to see this perspective all the way through. But to me, from the very beginning, the opening pages, and I think looking for those details is one of the great joys of going through Narnia. But from the very opening page, you know, when the children arrive in the country after coming from London, they want to go exploring. And Peter says, let's go look for eagles. And Edmund says, let's go look for foxes. And so you can see right from the very beginning that they're looking for different things, that they, you know, their character is identified just in what they're looking for from the very outset
of
the book.
That's right.
And so you see that all the way through. And the language, the showing that, you know, there's a lot of Chesterton in this to me, you know, just the paradox of everything. And that you can see everything so clearly in contrast. And Lewis is so good at that. And so presenting both perspectives simultaneously and in such a clear and vivid way, I think. What did you think?
I mean, I see that with even the very first entrances into Narnia.
Right.
So you've got Lucy. And one of the things about Lucy is that she gets captivated by this wardrobe in a room and there's fur coats and she likes them. And so part of her entrance into Narnia, she's drawn by her affections to the thing.
Right.
And she enters Narnia and everything she likes everything. It's all a delight to her. And then when Edmund goes in, and of course Edmund's been making fun of her for this make-believe place, he dislikes everything immediately. Right. And we see that in his character.
Right.
There's just this constant kind of dislike. And Lewis takes that and runs with it.
Right.
And as Edmund, you know, sides with the White Witch, when they come back into the real world, he chooses to be nasty. And because of his perspective, because of that dislike that he has towards A, appearing foolish, but also just Narnia itself, Lewis says that he becomes a nastier person every minute. And so there's something real going on, that perspective is not only just something that's here mentally.
Right.
There's something physical going on there, that he is now meaner and worse than he was.
Right.
So we see that perspective with especially Lucy and Edmund at the beginning, but this is something we see throughout the novel. What other examples are you thinking of?
So for instance, when Aslan's name is first mentioned, you know, you can, in Edmund, it strikes a chord of fear. And so he is shirking away from Aslan internally, while the other children, it alights in them like an enthusiasm and an attraction even, and and a joy. And so you can see that contrast in, you know, their affection toward Aslan. And then the journey through Narnia when, you know,
when
Aslan's on the move, that's right, and snow is melting. And for the children, you know, they have for them, it's a delightful journey. They're romping and it's beautiful. And it reminds me of the
spring
wind in the willows.
Coming.
That's right. Yeah. When spring is making its triumphant, you know, procession into the world. And so that's what's happening in Narnia. And the children are delighting in all these new flowers and all these new scenes and all these new smells. And Edmund, on the other hand, is, you know, beholden to the witch, and it's drudgery to him. I mean, he's like, you know, skulking through the mud, and he's tied, I think, even
he
to,
is,
you know, and
like
so,
a beast.
Yeah. And so, you know, his journey is so different than the other children. And so seeing those things, you know, in contrast, and even Aslan himself, when so many times throughout the book, you know, they'll say, well, he's, you know, he's a roaring beast and he's a gentle kitten, or he is, you know, a terrifying and delightful. And that's not the exact, I mean, I need the exact words in that, but, you know, they're showing that contrast in he's not safe.
Right.
But he's good.
Yeah.
You know, and so they're giving you, yeah. they're giving those opportunities of, for perspective consistently.
Lucy says at one point about his paws, terrible paws if he didn't know how to velvet them.
Right, you know? Right, exactly.
So oh, all of these right. beautiful, right. and that's one of the things I love about Lewis as just an author. And for a kid's book like this, is he's introducing them to beautiful symbolic language.
Right.
I want to go back to the journey because for, I think, both parties, you've got, Lewis brings this language of a dream up.
Right.
And it's like an unfolding dream mm-hmm. in both circumstances. But for one, it's a beautiful dream.
Right.
Where it's almost too real. Everything right. is popping up out of the ground. It's spring. All these mm-hmm. colors are coming to right. life. Right. All these new colors that haven't been seen in Narnia for years because right. of the snow. But then in Edmund's experience, the dream is a nightmare.
Right.
And he wants to escape it. And it's just this constant kind of nightmarish, shadowy language that Lewis is using.
Right.
So he's consistent
right.
about his metaphors and his, right. his writing.
And you know, that dream language is something that you see in a lot of books. I mean, that,
yeah.
you know, I love reading Narnia, particularly Lion, the Witch, and Wardrobe next to Princess and the Goblin. And you can mm-hmm. see, you know, Lewis loved MacDonald. He loved Chesterton. And you can see mm-hmm. so many of these allusions in this book. But, you know, that's one of the similarities between the two. When Irene sees the beautiful great-great-grandmother, and then she begins to doubt herself. And she said, you know, was that a dream? And Lucy does the exact same thing when she goes into the wardrobe. And
yes.
she's so steadfast in saying, no, this is real. This happened to me. This is truth. And then she has this doubt. And just, you know, the experience of doubt, even when you know the truth.
Because
you know,
it's universal.
Courage,
we
that's
all
right,
experience
but the
that.
Courage to be true and yeah. to say this happened. You know,
while you're on the Princess and the Goblin, there's also the scene about the feet when Aslan is melting all the statues or whatever he's
yes,
doing,
right.
changing
yes.
them back to people.
Yeah. Right.
And he says, once the feet are put right, all the rest will follow.
Right.
Which is in the Princess and the Goblin, the
goblin's feet are so distorted
are so, that they that right. is their weak spot.
Right.
Is their feet. And if the feet are put right, everything mm-hmm. else will be.
Which is really interesting. It took me. It actually took me rereading Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe to understand the significance of the goblin feet
mm-hmm.
When I was reading The Princess and the Goblin because, you know, it makes, you know, when your feet are on firm foundation, when your feet are pointed in the right direction,
right.
when you're solid, you know, mm-hmm. when your foundation is solid,
then
you know,
everything
then
else everything, will be right.
Yes, everything follows.
I mean, that is a great
it is. It's so
figurative. Apology for classical education even. You know, that's what we're trying to do,
that's
is
exactly
set that
right.
foundation. And then
yes.
and then students will be able to do a lot because they've got the foundational learning.
Well,
I thought I'd throw that in.
Well, exactly. Well, I think how that kind of applies to this literature is, yes, when you're teaching a book like this, I hope that you're teaching your students some of these things, but don't expect them to understand all of this symbolic language immediately. Or
we don't. I mean, every time
we've
I read this
over
else.
And over
right.
again. But what I do hope you do with a book like this is that you set their feet firmly,
right?
Point them in the right direction, and then over time allow them to read and read and read and discover and, what
yeah.
he's saying.
But you know that I think you're right. We don't want to belabor these points. We don't want to put classical philosophy and theology and heavy themes on these children, but you can hopefully give students these images that when they meet these bigger ideas, there is something tangible that they can hold on to. There's an image for them of, you know, a solid feet, you know?
That's
and
right.
There's a beauty there that's something that they can hold on to, an attachment for them in those ways.
And that when they get eventually to a metaphysics class.
Right.
Then as they're reading Plato
right.
and the forms and the ideas,
right.
maybe they'll see something and they'll remember something they read in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
But
and,
I think Lewis was trying to do it on their, he was
He's
trying
doing
to
it on
do
their
it
level.
For children. He's doing it for children. For children. Yeah. Yeah. But, yes. But that's another defense of reading these books carefully and slowly and thoughtfully because, you know, an individual sentence that we both picked up, you know, probably after multiple reads about Edmund's school or, right. you know, that this statement about, you know, the giants, oh, don't worry, Lucy, once the giants' feet are set right, everything will be fine. But mm-hmm. you have to, those sentences matter. The individual details right. matter because they're big ideas. And if you just treat a book, let's read this quickly and let's get the big ideas and, oh, you know, Narnia melted and, you know, Aslan, right. the right. lion and whatever, then you're not really getting all of these, you know, amazing gems.
You're
in
not
these
setting
books.
The foundation.
No, no. You have to be able, you, the details really, really count. And particularly with Lewis.
And I found...
Okay, good.
While you all were chatting, I found on, it's on page 68, where at the name of Aslan, each one of the children felt something jump in its inside, and the difference in their perspective
yes.
with Aslan, Edmund felt a sensation of mysterious horror. Peter felt suddenly brave and adventurous. Susan felt as if some delicious smell or some delightful strain of music had just floated by her. And Lucy got the feeling you have when you wake up in the morning and realize that it is the beginning of the holidays or the beginning of summer.
Yes.
It is. Every perspective is different and represents each personality mm-hmm. in the same way that when you pointed out what they wanted to look for, what right. animals they wanted to look for and right. Susan wanted to look for rabbits.
Right.
And
their individuality.
Just, he has a more gentle...
That's right.
Personality.
And they all have specific purposes. And Aslan exalts their individuality
yes.
so much in this book. I mean, when he, you know, the specific gifts that he gives them and the specific names that he gives them. And, you know, so calling them all to him. And, you know, at one point he says, you know, when they're in conflict with the queen and he says, come on, you have to be up here with us lions. And so in one way, he's being so inclusive and he's including them, you know, as lions in yeah. this battle against the witch. And so they're all one and, you know, they have this unity against this common foe. And yet he exalts their individuality so specifically throughout this book. And I just think that's beautiful.
There are a few other scenes that we want to talk about when it comes to perspective. And one of those is kind of this crucial, it's a scene where Peter and Susan are before the professor. Lucy has gone into Narnia. Edmund has gone into Narnia, but he's lying about it. And so they're concerned about Lucy. They think, has she gone mad? And there's this, what we're going to call the trilemma here. It's a logical problem, if you will, or a logical construction, where the professor essentially gives them three possibilities and also berates them for not being able to figure this out themselves. But this is related to Mere Christianity. Can I, Tanya? Thank you. So in Mere Christianity, which of course we recommend adults read alongside The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Lewis is doing the same thing here. He comes up with a trilemma about how we are to accept Christ as Lord. He's either a liar, a lunatic, or a Lord. And he says, a man who is merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with a man who says he has a poached egg, or else he'd be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. That's one option. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon. That's another option. Or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to.
That's so good.
And so as Christians, we find that very powerful, very moving, mm-hmm. and very important in our own way of thinking. But Lewis sets children up for that very same style of thinking here.
That's exactly right.
Because you've got Peter and Susan before the professor. And we find out later the professor has been to Narnia. He is one who is a true Narnian, evidently has been a king, or at least has seen others become a king and maybe a queen in Narnia. And he says,
page 48,
he says here, logic, said the professor half to himself. Why don't they teach logic at these schools? So
here
he's giving them
back to school.
Right.
He's giving Peter and Susan, you know, a real good talking to here. Mm-hmm. There are only three possibilities. either your sister is telling lies, or she is mad, or she is telling the truth. You know she doesn't tell lies, and it is obvious that she is not mad. For the moment, then, and unless any further evidence turns up, we must assume that she is telling the truth. And it's just this perfect, logical expression that students can hold on to. And down the road, because I do think we want them to read Mere Christianity in what, something like 12th grade?
It's in the curriculum. Yeah,
it's 12th grade. As a senior? Yes.
We send them out to college with their apologetics.
They ought to make that connection, mm-hmm. that this same trilemma, the same logical expression is applicable to our own faith. But there are other scenes as well that we want to talk about. And I think the last one that we'll kind of focus on as far as perspective is concerned is the witch herself and her self-perspective.
Right.
Whether she's queen or she's witch.
Right. And I think that's such a great example of perspective, because throughout the story, she calls herself the Queen of Narnia, but the children call her the White Witch.
Yes.
And so, you know, her perspective of herself, you know, is just riddled with pride. And the children see clearly and they call her what she is, which is a witch. And I think the best example of this is when the secret police come to Tumnus's. They leave the note on Tumnus's house, and in this note, you know, this is obviously the witch's captain, and he says, you know, that Tumnus is under arrest for high treason against her Imperial Majesty, Queen Chatelaine, I mean, Empress. And so all of these majestic words, I mean, she cannot exalt herself enough.
No, that's right.
And it's so false that she's using all of this language and all of these superficial things to exalt herself in a way that's not true. And the children just see right through it, and they call her a witch consistently throughout the story. But Edmund's the one that believes it. And he's the one that, you know, he is attracted to, you know, the queen. And he even wonders, you know, well, maybe, you know, maybe she's the one that's in the right. And so he is increasingly curious and attracted to, you know, what is wrong and what is bad. And he's lured by language. He's lured by comforts. He's lured by temptations. And it's
all the silly pleasures.
The silly things, right? Yeah. I mean,
Turkish delight.
The Turkish delight. And that's, you know, when he first meets the witch, it's the material comforts that attract him. I mean,
yes.
She gives him a robe and he's cold. She gives him a warm drink, and she gives him Turkish delight and sweet food. And so, you know, it's the material comforts that he's constantly seeking. And that's the only thing she can offer, though. She only offers the material things. But as he gets closer and closer to her, she withdraws those things, and it becomes increasingly uncomfortable. Like, I mean, beyond the point of indulgence, it's miserable.
That's
increasingly
right.
miserable. So what has initially attracted him now, he's absolutely repelled against.
There are two, I think, key lines
later
in the novel, in the text. One of them from Mr. Beaver, whom I love. I love Mr. Beaver. And the witch is standing before Aslan, trying to give Aslan a lecture on the deep magic, which is, of course, maybe another instance of perspective. She doesn't have quite enough
That's
perspective.
That's right. She hasn't gone to
the deeper magic. But Aslan tells her, you are correct in that as your who you are, the Emperor's hangman, which is what the Beaver calls her, you know, you do have the right or the authority to take a kill, to take a life, the life of a traitor. And Mr. Beaver pops in and says, oh, so that's how you came to see yourself as an empress, as a queen, because you were the emperor's hangman.
Right.
So Mr. Beaver and all true Narnians, they see through her self-delusion.
Right.
Because I think there is also a self-delusion that the witch has, but they can see through it. But then that self-delusion is related to her very magic, because there is a section when they go to finally rescue Edmund from the witch. She turns herself into like a stump and her dwarf into a stone. And Lewis says it was a part of her magic to make things seem what they are not. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a crucial thing to teach students, that there are ideas out there that revert what's real, what's true, and make seemingly untrue things true.
Right.
That's the witch's magic.
Right.
And we ought to see it as such. So we've seen this perspective of, or maybe even a self-deluded perspective of the witch. And a lot of that perspective, that self-delusion, is simply due to pride. And that's the next big question we want to talk about. How is pride destructive? Where do you guys see that in this text?
Well, clearly it's driving Edmund throughout yes. the entire story. I mean, he is in competition with Peter, and it says it explicitly throughout the book that he's in competition with Peter to get the recognition that he wants. And, you know, and he doesn't necessarily want Peter, you know, entirely defeated, but he would like for him to get his comeuppance
right.
a little.
Right. Well, and he says that. He says right. well, yeah. he doesn't really right. want him to be turned into stone.
That's right.
I mean,
that's right.
Lewis
that's
gives right. him gives him that much. He said he didn't really want that, but certainly not on the same level as whatever the witch had promised him or the queen
right.
in his view.
Right, right. Well, and the queen is clearly...
Well, the queen I mean, is the...
She's
even yeah. described as proud at yeah. the very right. beginning, just in her demeanor.
Yes.
She's full of pride. I mean, she has set herself up as a rival to Aslan.
Yes.
Which not very many people would have the nerve to do.
Well, and I think that that goes back to just, I mean, this goes back to Augustine. This goes back to Christianity at its source, is that pride is really the original sin. It's thinking that we can be like God. And there's right. a very much... that sense in the witch.
Yes.
And she's personified as pride. And then everything she does comes out of pride. We've already read the section
right.
where she calls herself all of these titles. Well, that's
right.
all
right.
driven by pride.
Right.
But let's delve a little deeper into, so we have pride, but how is it destructive? What is it actively doing throughout the text?
Well, it's brought winter.
It's brought winter.
It has
yes.
brought, yeah, an eternal winter until
yes.
Aslan comes to save it.
So it's taking away life.
That's right.
In some sense.
That's right.
It separated Edmund from everybody who loves him and everybody that he loves. His pride has separated him
that's right.
from life.
Yeah. His pride, when he takes on the idea, that proud idea that he can be prince, at least king, based on the witch's power and what she promises him, that leads him on this journey. And that whole journey is one of really descent. I mean, it is constantly descent. And I don't know, I can't remember if he actually descends a hill to the castle, but there is a sense in which he descends.
He's definitely...
And he becomes lower and lower yes,
and
lower.
In terrible
right.
shape
yes.
and terribly unhappy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Which is, you know, again, Princess and the Goblin, you know, they become so distorted within their values and mm-hmm. also their bodies that they, you know, descend underground. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just such a great illustration of what's happening. And
yes.
so, you know, internally you're descending, but then even, you know, when these authors can demonstrate that, you know, in physical, tangible, you know, ways for a student to see, it's that, you know, it's just that descent into an underground world
yes,
right. with distorted toes and feet,
yeah.
you know?
And well, it's hard to get back out of there.
That's
you
right.
know, yes. at one point Edmund says, deep down inside him, he really knew that the White Witch was bad and cruel.
That's right.
But he just still can't bring himself to turn away
pride
from her.
Pride is self-delusive. Right. I mean, it causes you to,
right.
to delude yourself. Mm-hmm. And the language... I really find the language here that Lewis uses is really helpful, and I think something to point out to students, because there are instances where he uses the term beast mm-hmm. or creature
right.
specifically in the context of pride.
Right.
Now, some of that is also not really just, because Lucy gets mad when Edmund lies and calls him you beast, but then she also turns mm-hmm. to Peter and Susan, because they're not believing her, mm-hmm. and calls them you beasts.
Right.
And there's a sense in which that makes sense. We right. we understand what that feels right. like to have someone
right.
not believe us, but
right.
it's not necessarily just. So there's an arc there where they too need to be
right.
humbled and made
right.
more and like Christ. But the beast language is constant, so much so that it eventually ends with, I think, Edmund on his journey when Aslan's on the move, takes the spot from being sat next to the queen in the sled, to being roped and tied almost like a beast of burden in front of the queen, and led, and he's the one now leading through the forest with a rope around his neck.
Right.
Like he's the
And there's there's great the language animal. In the back about, you know, like the variety of animals and how far they are from, you know, human, right? In the back, there's a great description of that. And, it, you know, it says that the witch is all bad. Like she's never, she's never, she has no connection to humans at all. And so she's entirely bad. And so the farther, you know, the more distorted you are from, you know, what is good. And but, you know, something else that you said that I think is interesting that, you know, we can see very clearly pride in Edmund in this situation and the queen clearly, but, you know, it affects all of the children. So there's an instance when after the professor introduces the trilemma to the children and Peter sort of counters back and says, but, you know, professor, if you can get to Narnia once, you shouldn't you be able to get to
always.
It again? And so he
what's
kind
real
of,
is always
yeah,
real.
Exactly. What's real is always real. And if it was available to us once, shouldn't it always be available to us? And it reminded me of an essay, which I believe is in Lewis's Letters to Malcolm. And it's a correspondence that he and his brother had. And Lewis says, you know, it's a little proud to think that we can do always what we can do once. Mm. It's like being, you know, it's like demanding of God.
That's
you know?
Right.
And so instead of counting our individual blessings when they occur, you know, we can't necessarily make these demands. And so because it was available once does not necessarily mean that it's available to us always. And
that's
I think,
good.
You know, it's interesting that Lewis puts that language in here and he wouldn't know that, you know, like, I mean, a student wouldn't necessarily know that, but it's an interesting point, I think, to say that we all are guilty of that, you know, in our daily lives and making assumptions and, you know, just maybe not being grateful for the things we should be grateful for, but always expecting a little more than maybe we deserve.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this book is a perfect example of pride coming before fall. Sounds cliche, but it truly
is. But it really is.
It's truly that, because ultimately the witch falls entirely due to her pride.
Right.
But Edmund is the one, I think, who experiences the full total reversal out of pride into something else.
After he has a talk with
Aslan.
What
do you see there,
Tanya? He has a talk with Aslan, and it turns him around because he listens. The witch also talks to Aslan.
She doesn't listen.
She does not listen. I mean, I think that's a huge point for us, is that, you know, we've got to listen.
Yes.
And she doesn't. She refuses to listen, which her pride, she never becomes humble. Edmund does become humble.
Yes.
On page 141... After he has his talk with Aslan, takes him off, and nobody else ever knows what was said between Edmund and Aslan. And it says, Edmund had got past thinking about himself after all he'd been through and after the talk he'd had that morning. So it wasn't just the talk with Aslan. It was also everything that he had experienced with her. Like, he looked on pure evil, and he made the decision to turn away from it.
That's right.
Well, and another example of this, too, I think, is when, you know, sort of what sets the story into motion, when Tumnus has kidnapped Lucy and then, you know, he ultimately reveals, you know, the situation to her in truth. And he does that. He submits and he gets that humility when he sees a picture of his father on his mantle, right? Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting thing that we can point out and connect in all of our stories. It's, you know, Tumnus realized that his father would be disappointed in him.
Right, there's
his father,
a good pride.
It's a great, yeah.
It's different than the pride we're talking about.
But it's also metaphoric. You know, he wanted the father to be proud of him, right? And we see that in, the same thing happens in Wind in the Willows, when Toad finally submits at the end of
that's
the Wind
right.
in the Willows. And, you know, the badger says, Toad, you know, what would your father say about this? You know, and then it's the language in Horatius at the Bridge, for how can man die better than facing fearful odds, for the ashes of his fathers, you know, and so it's this idea that, you know, we want to be worthy of, you know, I mean, we want our father to be proud of us.
We want nobility, which is, I think, the next thing we're going to talk about. And it's related to pride in this sense, in that it's really the foil. Throughout this, we get the foil of pride in nobility, because there is a sense in which the truly noble characters know who they are. There is a sense of self-pride that's true and right about them, that is this nobility. So what does it mean to be noble? What do we see here?
Well, I think there's a great example in the battle against the White Witch, and it's actually in the episode right before Peter is actually knighted by Aslan. And I think there's a great sentence in there, which is, you know, Peter did not feel very brave. Indeed, he felt he was going to be sick, but that made no difference to what he had to do. And so in that moment, you see Peter rise up and respond with a sense of duty, and he fights what is bad, regardless of his feelings about that. And I think that, you know, the willingness to do that is beautifully illustrated here. But also, I think it's interesting to talk about that in contrast to what happens to Edmund, right? Because Edmund is being attracted to the White Witch with all of these physical comforts with Turkish delight, and he's being tempted in physical ways. And even in the book, it says that when this happens, he loses his rationality.
Yeah.
And so he is becoming, you know, like less, he's becoming less noble. He is following his baser instinct, his animal, you know, appetites, right? Whereas Peter, when he's knighted, he does the complete opposite, right? He feels sick, but he acts with responsibility and duty. And so I like to see those things in contrast.
I think so. I think what you're seeing throughout this text. So we see throughout that the witch is always kind of de-ennobling characters. I mean, she's making them always less than they are. She calls Edmund a human. She calls Edmund a human vermin,
right,
or a human creature. She's always using that language.
Right.
And so you always see this de-ennobling, this descent into a lesser life form, a lesser being, so much so that her eventual goal is to turn things into stone.
Right.
Whereas Aslan is doing exactly the opposite. He's always ennobling, always bringing things and making them better than they are. And we see that perfectly in his refashioning of all the, his reforming all of the statues back into lively things and making them better, better than they are. But I see a lot of that in the language that's used. When Peter comes before Aslan, Aslan calls him, "Oh man," and calls him something that he's been on that journey into kind of manhood. You know, there is a transition out of the boyish Peterness into the man that Aslan is calling him to be, and then he knights him, and he becomes kind of that in manifest.
You know, something else that's interesting about this is that when we use the term nobility, it's used in terms of character,
yes,
right? And so that's something that I think, again, Princess and the Goblin helps us point out, that Curdy, you know, Curdy is the noble character, and, you know, he's the son of a miner. It has nothing to do with circumstance. It's entirely, you know, dependent on character. And so, you know, when Peter is knighted, it's only because of the way he behaves,
yes,
and because
that's
of
right.
his duty and because of his character. And so I think that's an important thing to point out when we're talking about words like nobility. You know, it
doesn't have anything to do with family line or being do that for any other reason than that you have those noble characters.
Well, that's Mr. and Mrs. Beaver.
Right.
They're these homely little beavers that live in a little beaver dam.
Right.
And yet they
you
become
really like those little beavers.
They're great.
Yeah. I love them. And they're just doing their thing. And yet they're the ones tasked with bringing the humans, the sons of Adam and the daughters of Eve, before Aslan.
Right.
And there's a sense in which they kind of become, after that, a part of Aslan's retinue. I mean, they're of a higher being than they were. And there's something else that Mr. Beaver says at one point that gets back to this ennobling idea, where he's talking about who the witch is. And it turns out the witch actually isn't human, even though she tries to pass herself off as human. And he says to Peter and the other children, you know, not to blame your father, Adam, and he bows his head. There's something about being sons of Adam or daughters of Eve, which we are, that's ennobling. And somewhere else, Lewis is talking about being a son of Adam due to Adam's fall is both a shame and a dignity. It's something that is something that dignifies us because we're made in the image of God. We are humans. And so you see throughout that Aslan and the true Narnians, they are the ones who recognize that nobility of being human and of being man or woman, that the witch doesn't. She calls them, at times, sons of Adam and daughters of Eve, but there's also a sense in which that's just, for her, a title that's sort of meaningless, I think. Where else do we see this ennobling?
Aslan is the...
I mean, I think that's it. I think it all points
right.
It all points to the end.
It's all pointing to his nobility and their recognition of that. Even before, just to hear his name.
Yes.
That it gives everybody, you know, everybody stops, even with the name itself mm-hmm. carries nobility. And is that because of a reputation that he has? Where does that come from?
It doesn't, to them, Lewis even says, they didn't know anything about Aslan. They know as much about Aslan as you do, the reader.
Right.
And yet there's something about the name itself.
Right.
That it's carries that some, weight.
It's and that import. Innate need mm-hmm. that we all have and mm-hmm. that recognition of that need being met mm-hmm. in right. that creature that we're all drawn to.
It reminds me of Augustine, right? The heart is restless till it rests yeah. in thee, right?
Yeah. It's just
right.
that,
what is it, Pascal? God has hole in our heart, right?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Is it, yeah. Lewis refers to that too, yeah. right? Is that?
Yeah. So I think that's really obvious here, even before Aslan appears.
That's right.
But then after he does appear, everything about him is noble. And my favorite thing, and maybe it's because, you know, when my children were little and if they were being bullied or something, I always told them that if they just didn't react, that it infuriates bullies because mm-hmm. they need the person they're bullying to get on their level. And then that justifies what they're doing. And so at the point when the witch is, they've got Aslan and she says to muzzle him. And it says, and so they're putting this muzzle on him. One bite from his jaws would have cost two or three of them their hands, but he never moved. And this seemed to enrage all that rabble. So they needed him to react in order to justify what they were doing. And he didn't. He just stood firm. And I mean, it's the same thing with Jesus before Pilate, with the crown of thorns, all the humiliation, dragging his own cross. I think it's all very, I think Lewis has done an excellent job of placing that kind of humility and on Aslan, which does make him noble.
Yeah.
Right.
There's an upside down
right.
power.
Which,
yes.
here. You
yes.
know, and when you point that out and the significance of that is, you know, being humble when, you know, pride or, you know, something else, you know, would be, you know,
or self-defense,
right? Yeah. But you know, you see that in Lassie. The
yes.
same thing happens to Lassie, right?
That's right.
When she's captured and she has that same sort of dignity in terms of just letting the circumstances be, and
she doesn't
you know,
react, she doesn't attack,
right? Right. And then even in Charlotte's Web, you know, when Charlotte and Wilbur, you know, and I talked about this in the Charlotte's Web episode, where when they're really at the pinnacle of, you know, of success, you know, and the word in the air is humble, right?
Right.
And so the temptation to pride, you know, is so great at that moment, but the word is humble, you mm-hmm. know? And so I think it's great to just point these things out, you know, in consistency, and you can see the significance of it and how it can play out in, you know, really small ways.
Well, and everything that the witch wants, all that power,
right.
all that grandeur that she gets in her pride is not available to her in her pride. It's
right.
available to those who are humble. And that's part of being noble, is that you truly can become better and greater and more than you are. And in that sense, there's almost a pride that you could or ought to have in that status. But true nobility is saying, wow, I could have all of that pride and status, yet I'm humble because...
In this moment.
But yet, there is a piece of Aslan too, that and a piece of King Arthur and a piece of all of the characters that are in leadership that requires some kind of strictness.
Yes.
And yeah. it's not, well, there was the line, and I don't know where it was, where it says he was terrible. Oh, people who have not been in Narnia sometimes think that a thing cannot be good and terrible at the same time.
Right.
And so we can't ignore that side of nobility,
no, that's
too.
Right. That's
that
good.
It does come with a lot of responsibility
mm-hmm.
and with the need to guide people in the right way. And the thing that kind of confuses me about this, and maybe you all can straighten me out, you Narnia lovers, is when Lucy is tending to Edmund, And then Aslan comes to her and says, there are other people wounded. And she says, yes, I know. Wait a minute. And he says, daughter of Eve, in a graver voice, others also are at the point of death. Must more people die for Edmund? I mean, that was like strong. Mm-hmm. She was caring for her brother. So what?
I mean, I think you've already.
What's going on there?
I think you already understand it.
Like
you've already moving her on. You've got it that true nobility requires others to do things that are hard.
Yeah.
And it requires response from those over whom you have authority. And Aslan is the ultimate authority, and he's telling her, you have to do other things. There are other duties that you have. Mm-hmm. And even if it's your own brother whom you love, you have to move on. He also, I think, knows the efficacy of what she's doing. He knows, and she knows, because she's been told by Father Christmas that this will heal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so there is a sense in which there's an urgency now to save others that you have to respond to.
And trust it.
And trust
it. You have to trust it.
And just the opposing elements of that nobility. And, you know, I think there's a great essay in Lewis's journalistic essays, and he defines the knight. And he says, you know, the knight is perfectly meek at the table and perfectly strong in the field. And so, you know, he says that, you know, to be a true knight is not to be the average of the two things, but it's to be both.
That's right.
In perfect contrast. Yeah. And so, you know, I think that's what you're seeing when Aslan is, you know, terrible and good. And, you know, I mean, he has that true nobility, which is, you know, perfection on both ends of a spectrum that we can't meet, but which we can strive toward as ideals.
Right. And which Jesus also, you know, we think the gentle lamb, but
he turns over tables in the
temple
courtyard as well.
He tells people,
he has zeal.
Give everything away or you can't follow me. I mean, he's tough. But that I think is where you can truly see nobility is when somebody can have all of that gentleness and the love and care for people, but also saying the hard things and putting them on the right track and not letting yourself be distracted by the minutiae. But being able to see the whole overview and how what needs to be done in order for the entire mission to move forward.
Yeah.
And that requires sacrifice on everybody's behalf. Mm-hmm.